We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
In the Know, the Bourbon Street Shots podcast. It's all Pelicans, all the time. And welcome to the podcast. It has been 7 games since Mike and I have talked on a podcast about this. So, we have lots to talk about, Mike.
We do. And since then, it's been loss, win, loss, win, loss, win, loss. So you know what's going to happen Tuesday night.
Could you win? Are you sure about that? Are you really going to bet on that?
Yeah, I mean, patterns are patterns for a reason, Ryan. It's going to continue. This is a 500 team that has alternated losses and wins since December 1st. So this entire month is just going to be an alternation of loss and wins. This is what they teach us in school with patterns and logic and stats and yada, yada.
Yeah. What I do find is a little funny is, you know, at the beginning of the season, everybody's like, well, you know, Solomon Hill's out. This team's probably going to, you know, win 45 games at best, 43 games, something like that. And they're sitting at 15-15. And when the losses happen, people act like I get all kinds of like flipped out reactions. And when the wins happen, I get all kinds of like euphoria, especially if it's two in a row. And it's like even our best guesses, our best estimates for this team with its current health was kind of like 15-15 was like, yeah, that's what I don't understand that. That's perfect. Makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah, I guess, but okay. So it also matters the way you lose. And I had some time this morning while I was on the toilet. So I did a little research and the last five Pelicans losses, they led by double digits in the third quarter in all of them. And in four of those games, they were up by at least 15 in the third quarter. And yet they lost all of those games. Now, I had to go back season by season, so I gave up after about 20 seasons. But that has not happened to any team in the last 20 seasons. If they were just losing, like if you just get thoroughly beat down or it's a close game and you lose whatever – but the last five games, there's all the arguments in the world that you could make that they should have all been wins or at least three or four of them. I mean, to be up double digits in all of them in the third quarter and by 15 and four out of five, and the one they weren't up by 15 was Sacramento at home, where if you're up by 10 against Sacramento at home, that's like a 30-point lead. So, I mean, that is why I think people are so frustrated because they're showing that they should be able to run off six, seven, eight game win streaks or win 8 of 10 and they just find ways to blow these games in which they're the significantly better team for large amounts of the game.
So, is there any logical explanation for this? Like, can we point to the fact that the three best players on this team are playing obscene numbers of minutes compared to everybody else in the league, or does that not matter? Like, they should be able to suck it up and play through it and be able to carry them to a win. Are they just too tired in the fourth quarter? Like, do you have a theory on this?
I never think it's one thing. I could point to three or four things. I know what the coaches think. I know that that they tend to think that when the Pelicans go up big, that certain guys do a little bit of stat padding or stat hunting as opposed to just, you know, continuing to play the team game and the way they got them the lead, and then just lack of concentration. But yeah, I think fatigue could be a factor. I think a huge factor is that this team is not getting into the bonus early anymore. I mean, when you're a jump shooting, and that's basically what they've become, a jump shooting team that plays little to no defense, you go on a cold stretch and then all of a sudden you give up a lead. The easiest way to combat that is to be getting into the bonus, be getting to the line, and they're just not doing that anymore. I mean, I can't remember the last time I saw this team in the bonus early in a quarter twice in a game, and it seemed like the first couple of games this year they were, you know, in the bonus every quarter. You know, halfway through the quarter. So I think you could point to four to five things. I think they start taking the air out of the ball rather than stepping on throats and continuing to push the lead. I never think anything is just one thing, but getting back to your why people aren't satisfied with 500, it's because we could all point to six or seven games in which we say, okay, with just a, you know, a non-horrific performance in this quarter or this stretch or this half, the Pelicans easily win that game and they look like the better team. So I think that's why people are frustrated and why the coaching staff and team is frustrated, to be frank.
Right. Yeah, I mean, but if you look at this in a vacuum. Go ahead.
Yeah, if you ask the players or the coaches, what do you think they think their record should be?
Oh, I don't know. Probably like 18 and 12 or something like that.
Yeah, or better. So I mean, I guess just that's why. I mean, you could look at games in which they were handily defeated and it is what it is, or even like the two Raptors games where they played good and they played close and they just lost to a team that was just a tiny bit better. But then you look at these past five losses and then even the Timberwolves game back in November, and it's just you could start to see little ones where it's like, oh my God, you know, this team shouldn't have lost the games that they lost. And conversely, like, how many games can you think of that this team won where you felt like, wow, they got lucky, or they came back from down 18 and, you know, and overcame this team the way everybody does to us? So it just feels like all the 50-50 games have gone the other way. So I guess that's why people seem frustrated with 15 and 15.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you want to look at it just objectively, you say losses to Houston, Golden State, Sacramento, and Denver. Like, the Houston and Golden State ones should be expected. The Denver one is unfortunate. It was an OT. And the Sacramento one is the one where you're like, what the hell? And so let's talk about the Sacramento one. What the hell? Seriously, that was one of the most foul-tempered I've ever walked away from a basketball game. I was hot after that one.
Wow, okay. I hope you calmed down since. Yeah, I mean, that one was just so many times, you know, the Pelicans could have easily taken over the game and put it away, and they just kind of fumbled around with them, and then to be up by 9 points with, you know, 3 minutes and 19 seconds left. And then, I mean, not only that, but So it's 100-92. Pelicans have the ball. AD misses a point blank shot. Sacramento still doesn't score. Cousins comes back down, misses another shot, you know, 2 feet. I mean, like, there was chances to push that lead up to 10 with 2.5 minutes left, you know, and the game at that point is all but over. And then Buddy starts hitting. Pelicans just take some terrible shots. And then what wind up showing itself the next week, the shot for the to put them ahead or hopefully win the game again, we get the ball to Holiday from mid-range, and that doesn't work. But, yeah, I mean, there were just so many chances to put that game away, and that's what's frustrating about this team. Early in the games, you know, this team will play with fire and get way ahead, and it's like they become bored. And I would get that if you're like Golden State or a team who's been there, done that, and you're just like kind of waiting for the postseason. This is the opposite of that, and there's still no sense of urgency. So that's what worries me.
Yeah, I mean, so there's one play in the fourth quarter, and it just I thought it was the perfect metaphor for the entire game. Buddy Hield drives past Ian Clark, gets right into the middle of the lane. He's slowed down by Anthony Davis, who then kind of bumps into Cousins. And Hield continues to drive in this slow-mo fashion around Cousins. And Davis slides around Cousins, so he's there to pick up Hield again. And then both Cousins and Davis just stop. They stop moving. Hield takes another dribble, another step. Slow-mo. Like, he's completely lost all momentum because he's been bumped like 5 times at this point. And he gets a little layup. And it's down to like 4 then at that point. And I was like, if either of those two bigs had just thought, I'm going to try, there's no way he'll get that shot off. If they even tried, there was no way he was getting that shot off. And they just did not give a damn through that fourth quarter. They're like, yeah, we're good. There's no way Sacramento's coming back from this. We just don't have to give much of a crap. And they're gonna let us win. Like, it made no sense to me. Like, I wasn't annoyed with Zach Randolph going off, you know, whatever. That's fine. He wants to hit every jumper he takes. It doesn't happen very often. But just some of the plays in the fourth quarter where they just obviously felt like they had this wrapped up and they didn't need to have to give a crap, it drove me crazy. So, stupid second
quarter
game.
I totally agree, and I just, again, I could see falling asleep at the wheel if you're a team that's had so much success that it's hard to get excited in December. Like, every one of these games, especially with the rest of the West stumbling. I mean, again, 15-15, they win 3 of these games that they definitely should have won. And I could point to 6 or 7 that to me were games that they should have won 60% of the time or more. They're the 4 seed right now. And it's just, you would think that there's all this motivation. Boogie's never been in the playoffs. He's in a contract year. AD's been in the playoffs once and got swept out. Jrue Holiday just got this huge contract and looked improved in his way. You got these older veterans who this might be their, you know, a guy like Jameer Nelson and Tony Allen might be their last year in the league. And instead, it's just kind of like this casualness that I just don't understand when they're finishing games. So again, 500, yeah, we'd take that compared to where we've been the last couple of years. But it's worrisome that this team just over and over again, when they have a chance to really move up in the standings and really assert themselves and kind of make a run, while Utah has Gobert out again and Denver had this stretch without Jokic and Millsap, and now Jokic is back and Portland was struggling and Minnesota's running on fumes. Like, the Pelicans really could have asserted themselves, you know, and not only be in the playoffs this year, but be in prime position to actually win a first round series, which would be monumental for this team, and especially if they want to keep Boogie. I mean, it would be very hard for me to see him leaving if this team gets to the playoffs and wins a first-round series. So all of those factors, Gentry fighting for his job, Dempse fighting for his job, and there's still just not a lack of urgency. It's a little worrisome. If you're being an optimist, you're probably saying, well, they've shown they could do it. Once they flip that switch, you know, they'll start winning these games, and they're the fourth, you know, best team in the Western Conference, and nobody's run away from us yet on that. But it's just, personally, I'm not going to believe it until I see it for a month or two in a row with this team. And I just don't know if they have the personalities to kind of have that killer instinct.
All right. Let's talk X's and O's real quick.
Do it.
First three quarters, you just said it. Like, our team racks up assists, racks up easy cutting into the lane for layups. They're drilling open three-point shots, and they are manufacturing open three-point shots all over the floor. They have a little bit of turnover problems here and there. In the first three quarters, they'll have like one quarter where suddenly they'll be a little bit of a disaster. But in general, the first three quarters, they're looking pretty smooth. Like Houston, Milwaukee, Denver, against Philly, against Sacramento, like these, every single one of these games, like you said, they're up 15 at some point in the third quarter. And you're seeing a really nice brand of ball. In the fourth quarter, we go to post-ups. We're going to these vanilla post-ups over and over again. Are we doing that because the other teams are ratcheting up their defense and stopping the kind of penetration the team was getting before? Or are we doing that because they're tired? Or are we doing that because we think that's actually the best way to score in the fourth quarter? Those are my three options. Do you have another one?
No, and I think it's a little bit of a couple. So one, I do think other defenses step up in the fourth quarter. I mean, that's just universal throughout the NBA. The teams actually start to play defense in the fourth. I think another part of it is they get more spooked in the fourth quarter with an injury or two than they do in other ones. Like, you know, they'll try to move the ball and get the ball going at certain parts, but then they'll make a bad pass, and all of a sudden it just terrifies, I don't know if it's the staff, the players, or both, but then you just see after a bad turnover, they just start to play more conservative. And yeah, it's just something that I don't agree with. I think if you lose the same, if you play the same way you did the first three, and you lose playing that way, you could live with it. But changing it just out of, you know, fear of loss. And I don't think any play shows us this better than, you know, the end of the game against Denver, which I have so many problems with that last play for Holiday. But without even thinking about the play, just think about the mindset. So the game's tied. You want the last shot. But what you don't want is a turnover. And what you're basically saying with that play is that you don't trust your players to do anything complicated, to do any movement, even to set a screen without it, you know, being an offensive foul, which gives Denver the ball back. You know, it shows to me the exact type of, you know, passive play not to lose mentality and just kind of hope to win that I don't think the great teams have. Like Houston might do the same play, but it's because they have the best, literally the best ISO player on the planet in James Harden. But I mean, overall, Houston's mentality would not be to take the air out of the ball in the fourth quarter and to go away from what they've been doing all game. And if you really want to be one of the great teams, you can't, you just got to go all in and believe in what you do all 48 minutes, not get scared off by the possible downside of what you believe in.
Yeah. And I also noticed they kind of abandoned some of their tricky stuff in the fourth quarter. And I know why. Like, again, like you said, they're being risk averse and they don't want to worry about these passes that they're trying to squeeze in tight spaces. But like, have you ever seen them run that play where they have Drew cut between the two bigs? And instead of running out to the corner, immediately seal his man, receive the ball, and try to score in the fourth quarter, even once?
No. I mean, they run a lot of beautiful stuff throughout, you know, the regular parts of the game, and then just all of a sudden, it really stops later in the game.
The side pick and roll with Boogie and Rondo has become a beautiful thing, because Rondo will just I can't tell you how much I appreciate watching Rondo take the ball baseline and under the basket come out the other side, and seeing our guards make all or wings make all the right decisions where just the right one dives to the middle and receives a pass. Moore is a and Drew, actually, both of them are just magnificent at that. Like, and they never, like, I've seen our team do this before in the past where they weren't particularly bright about this, where two of them would dive, bringing, you know, at least one defender with them, and it just wouldn't work. It's like only one dives, they get to the right spot, and, you know, the guy finds them, and they get a nice, you know, floater or layup. Like, it's great to see that. And then the fourth, you don't see any of it. You see vanilla post-ups and Boogie trying to throw the ball cross-court through three people.
To me, it's as simple as this. Think about how happy the Denver coaching staff was when they saw the final play in that. Like, you know, they're on the sidelines terrified about this possibility, that possibility. Like, if Mike Malone got to draw up the play that the Pelicans were going to run, he would draw up a Drew ISO with everybody else, just kind of like that would be what Denver wanted. And that's exactly what we do. To me, it's as simple as, okay, what would the other team be most afraid of? Let's do that. And Gentry did the exact opposite. I don't want to get this into a Gentry bashing pod, because even in that Denver game, there was over 200 plays, and that was one of them. So there's a lot of other things that could have changed that game where they wouldn't have even needed a last-second shot. But I think that play kind of shows the team's overall mentality. When things get tight or in the fourth quarter, when they have a lead, they just, for some reason, play not to lose as opposed to win.
Yeah. All right, now I have to do something that's going to be very strange. I'm going to talk positively about the team, okay? So, have you watched a Hornets-Pelicans team that has over extended 5-6-7 game period shown the shooting prowess that this Pelicans team displays?
No, I mean, it's like the closest I've ever seen to this was one stretch when Glenn Rice was shooting like this, but it was one person.
Yeah.
And this is like a whole team playing like Glenn Rice did in that season where he was a legit MVP candidate.
Yeah. I mean, it is absolutely bananas how good Moore and Rondo and Drew Holiday and Darius Miller have been over the stretch. They're on fire. Like, even the one game where Boogie actually took a lot of threes, he was hitting them. So I are you worried like I am that this kind of shooting is has to come back at some point and it's going to hurt us? Or do you think they'll just find other ways to score in that situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think they'll find the ways. I think that, you know, a lot of almost all the shots are open or wide open, and I think that's somewhat sustainable. It's not like, you know, they're shooting shots with hands in their face or off the, you know, dribble threes. And just hoisting them up. I mean, if you go watch an NBA practice, the rate that these guys hit threes at, 80-90%, they could hit open and wide open threes where they don't have to create for themselves. So I think that is sustainable. And even if it's not, it'll be able to be supplemented by what I would hope would either be lack of turnovers or maybe, a little bit more of an emphasis on hitting the offensive glass, which you would hope they would do. But I guess long story short, I am not worried about the offense regressing. I think it's going to be a top 10 offense for the rest of the season with the ceiling of a top 5 if they could get the turnovers under control.
Yeah. Like, I think I've told you this before. There's nothing that makes me happier than three-point shooting. And watching this past month has been a lot of fun for me. Just, I like having players that I actually don't cringe every time they loft the ball. And I think there was one season in the past three where Eric Gordon made me feel that way for like most of the season, that he could hit everything he took. And I never felt that way about Ryan Anderson, even though he was supposed to be our other awesome shooter. So it's been great having guys that, if Darius Miller has his feet set, it's in. Like, I don't care. He's hitting that. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, even Dante from his certain spots is starting to get better after a slow start.
Let's not get carried away.
Well, after slow
start. We can't say good things about Dante.
Drew and Dante were terrible to start. They've picked it up as of late. And Moore's obviously been fantastic. But, yeah, you have to respect, you know, all of their guys on the court. So it's, you know, it's definitely something that I think it'll maintain enough for those guys to be a threat, and for the Pelicans, you know, I think it'll be a rare game when they're not at, you know, at least 9 threes made, if not double digits. I think that's going to happen almost every game. To me, when they shoot the ball goes in. So I would be trying to figure out more opportunities for them to shoot the ball. Obviously, the turnover percentage is the first thing they need to fix. I mean, to be second worst in the league in turnover percentage, and to be turning the ball over, 16.5 times a game is just beyond stupid for this team. And then, you know, Finch talked about it a little bit in an article that Scott Kushner put out yesterday, where he said that he really loved what the offense has been doing, but if he could change one thing, it would be focusing more on the offensive glass, that they think they could do that and play transition D. And if you could cut down the turnovers, if you could get a couple more offensive rebounds, and you get this team 6 or 7 more shots per game, field goal attempts per game off of that, like I said, then this is a top 5, maybe even top 3 offense, right behind the Houstons and Golden States of the world. So that would be my next focus if I were them.
Okay. Do you think they're ever going to be good at defense?
Tell me if the turnover stuff. I really believe, I know you could turn the ball over and still have a good defense. I really believe that a big reason why the defense isn't good is because of all the live ball turnovers. And the ones that don't even count are when Boogie gets his shot blocked, or when he the 3 times a game when he drives to the basket out of control, throws something up looking for a call, and then lays on the floor or gripes. Like I said, 16.5 turnovers, but then also count all those Boogie blocks, all the times he drives out of control and doesn't get back down on the play. I would say there's at least 4 or 5 of those a game. So you're talking about, okay, even if not every turnover is a live ball turnover, you're talking about probably between 15 and 18 times a game in which the defense is just in transition in some kind of crazy chaotic limbo where they're outnumbered. What are the points off of turnovers lately been? I mean, they've been in the mid-20s almost every game.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I don't think they're a terrible half-court when they're set defense. I think if the turnovers come down and Boogie gets back on D, which are two huge ifs, but if those things happen, then all of a sudden you're looking at a closer to a middle-of-the-pack defense.
Yeah. Okay. I do want to mention one thing I thought was perhaps the funniest thing I saw in any of these games was when, I don't remember even who was against at this point, but there was a fast break, and Boogie actually hunted the guy from behind. He ran down the court all out, caught the guy, blocked it from behind as he went up for a layup, and there was a scrum, and there was 4 other team jerseys under the basket. They got the offensive rebound, and they put it back, and Gentry called a timeout. He was pissed off, and he made the 3 guys on the Pelicans who didn't run back, all of them were put to the bench immediately. Boogie. He just left him on there. And I think this is the first time I've seen Boogie run back. And Gentry tried to like tell Boogie, hey, this is how I'll back you up if you run back. But then the very next play, Boogie, like, he lost the ball, and he just kind of watched the entire other team run down, score, and come back, and he barely even made it to half court. And I'm like, all right, like, even if you try to give that kind of reinforcement to Boogie, and he's not going to pay any attention to it. And why is he still in the game? If you're trying to send that message, why leave him in the game after he does this on the very next play? It's so ridiculous. Like, he just does, I think you remember me saying probably like 2-3 years ago that I did not want Boogie on this team for anything. And, you know, there's still times where I watch him play, and I'm like, oh my God, just get rid of him. But, you know, he's a talent.
Yeah, it is what it is at this point. I know that exact sequence you're talking about, and my favorite part of that sequence you left out is when Boogie did run back and make the block. And I think a big part of why he was sprinting is because he turned it over.
Yes,
so he was fixing his mistake, and that's why you finally saw him hustle. But you go to the timeout, and Boogie sits on the bench, and he just gives the nastiest stare to his teammates. And I'm like, you gotta be effing kidding me. This guy never gets back, and now he does it one time, and he's gonna stare down the teammates like that? Like, that was just beyond, like, just hypocritical. I thought that was hysterical that he did that. So, I mean, it is what it is, and he's the player he is. And, you know, he has his faults. Every player has their faults. You can't want any player to be perfect. But to me, it's all about the attitude with him. Like, I'd take the turnovers. I would take the times where he gets blocked by far inferior players because he has no lift. I would take, you know, the terrible fouls that he picks up. I would take it all if he just, you know, had a great attitude. And didn't have that sourpuss face 20 times a game and didn't argue with the official. So, you know, I'm not asking the guy to be perfect, but just let me enjoy the game and watch it and have guys I could root for. And I personally don't feel that way with him. And, you know, it is what it is. They're not going to trade him, so I better get behind it. But I'll never be a fan. I know I won't.
Okay. I asked you this before. I'm going to see what is the update on Mike's favorite player to watch on this team. Is it still Rondo, or has it changed?
It's not really Rondo because they don't give him as many opportunities as I'd like them to give him. Favorite player to watch. I don't know. I would say that almost every time Etuan Moore goes up with a shot, I feel like it's a good shot and I enjoy it, but there are a couple of limitations he has and things that frustrate me a little bit that I wouldn't say he's my favorite. I would say it's Cook. I want to see Cook get some playing time. If you watch him in the G League, he's fantastic to watch, so I'm a Cook fan.
That's such a cop-out.
It's Anthony Davis, obviously, but after that, I mean, it really would be Rondo. I just don't think they give him the keys as often as he should get them.
Yeah. If it wasn't for the very last play breakdowns we keep seeing, I would probably be leaning towards Drew at this point. Like, aggressive mode Drew is fun as hell.
Yeah.
Put him up top and have him try to go against the other team's best defender and score. when the other team is, when your team is just laying back, it's a terrible idea, and we know it's not going to end well, but put him in the flow of the game when he's receiving the ball and things are happening and the defense isn't set, and when he takes people to the hole, it is fun. So, I don't know. I'm leaning a little bit towards Drew.
Yeah, Drew isn't. I still want him to get to the line more, and a lot of people say that he should. He's just not getting the calls, and that might quite possibly be true. But yeah, that's really been my only beef with him the last couple of weeks, because he's been shooting fantastic. His defense, you know, has been good. So that would be my only thing. Is it still? I don't understand how a guard who could play so physical and who likes to post up and, you know, could get to the rim when he wants to and cuts well. Like, why does that guy not get to the free throw line? Nothing crazy. 5-6 times a game. Like, that's the only piece of his game I'm still a little frustrated by. But other than that, yeah, I think he's been great the past couple weeks.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest. I've heard, you know, Joel Myers calls it out all the time. Like, and he still doesn't get a call. He says it all the time when Drew goes to the basket. Like, if you watch those carefully, like, refs are looking for some sort of physical thing to happen. They're not, like, their eyes are definitely looking for hands to come down on arms and things like that. But they're also looking to see how much did that guy shift as a result of the contact. And Drew has, like, mastered this knack where he can try to still get off a really solid shot, but it usually involves some sort of acrobatic, slithery move that reduces the contact that he's absorbing. So his body doesn't fly. He doesn't do the Chris Paul head jerk like somebody just mugged him. So he is basically doesn't look like he's getting that hit that hard, even if he is getting hit. So I understand why they're not calling it as much. It sucks, but maybe he should master the jerk your head back thing that Harden and Paul and other players do all the time. What do you think? Would that annoy you, or would you enjoy that?
No, I mean, I'd be completely fine with whatever it took. Like, if you've got to play the game, if you've got to sell it, fine. Go ahead and do whatever it takes at this point. I think that there has to be something, because they need a third guy on this team who could get to the line, or at least accrue fouls on the opposing team to build up and get closer to the bonus. So, whatever it takes, I'm completely good for. So yeah, I mean, that's a good pick for your favorite guy to watch. We talked a lot about the frustrating things. And the negative, we have had 3 wins since you and I taped last. We had the Denver game at home, we had the Philly game at home, and then the Milwaukee game. What was your favorite win and why?
I'm tempted to say Philly, but I think I'll go Milwaukee. I enjoy both of them. Like Philly, and I understand people are like, oh, but Embiid wasn't playing, so it just doesn't matter. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. Like, we play games all the time with players missing, and we managed to win. Like, Cousins carried us to a win we shouldn't have had when with Davis out. So, I don't know, the whole Philly game was fun, and I liked that it came out of the win. But Milwaukee, I just felt like they were picking a team that is really athletic and quick apart, and for a lot of the game, and that's what I enjoyed so much. Was there was like a balanced attack. Everybody was getting theirs. Rondo was carving them up, and it was just open look after open look, and it was so much fun to watch. And yeah, Giannis was having his moments there, here and there, going to the rim, but even him in the fourth quarter, he just really couldn't get anything going, and the refs were a little bit annoying in that game, but I still enjoyed it a lot. What was your favorite one?
Yeah, I like the Milwaukee game. That one felt good because, to me, I'm sitting there going, oh, my God, you know, the Pelicans win this game, and Milwaukee had 95 field goal attempts to the Pelicans 80. Yeah. And you're just sitting there going, good God, if this team could get rid of the turnovers, like they could not only beat a good team like Milwaukee, who has been, I think going into the game, they were something like 7-2 since acquiring Bledsoe or something like that. Not only a good team, but they could demolish teams like that if they just, you know, reduced the turnovers a little bit and got even close to the same number of field goal attempts as their opponent. So that one was satisfying to me for that reason, because, again, if I do want to think optimistically, I could see stretches, I could see evidence that this team could not only be good, but it could be elite. It could be, you know, top notch. So that was the one that probably gave me the most optimism of all of them. The Philadelphia game, yeah, Embiid was out, and I just felt like they were clearly the better team in that game. It was great to see Holiday just absolutely go off. But there was just so many times where, like, Ben Simmons picked them apart on, like, the most obvious stuff I've ever seen. And I'm like, good God, if this rookie is just picking them apart, like, he would just post up and guys would cut and the Pelicans, like, oh, my guy cut? I didn't know they're allowed to do that. And, like, layup after layup. And Ben Simmons just driving. How many dunks do you think Ben Simmons had in that game? And I'm just like, you know, that one was a win, but it was more like it was frustrating for that. And because they got an offensive rebound absolutely any time they wanted it. So those two things. But, again, similar to the Milwaukee game, Philly takes 96 shots in that game. The Pelicans take 80 and they still win. And it's just like, it's just, you just want to strangle somebody, because if they do one or two things differently, they're not only beating all these teams, they are blowing out a lot of good teams.
Yeah. Yeah. So we were supposed to be saying good things. This is wins. Good things.
Yeah, Milwaukee. Great. I had such a fun time watching that game.
Okay. So, on Milwaukee, if you could have your pick of anyone except for Giannis, of course, which basically brings it down to what, Middleton and Bledsoe, and that's pretty much it. Like, if we had traded for Bledsoe, do you think you would have been a difference maker for this team?
No, because Drew wouldn't be playing as good as he's playing right now. I could pick anybody. I guess I would go with Brogdon, just because I've been looking around lately, and I'd be curious to see what you think of this. I think the Pelicans are basically going to make the playoffs by default. I think there's really only 8 teams that can make the playoffs now. I think we're about to see Utah go on a huge swoon. With Gobert down and just an impossible schedule. So the Pelicans are going to make it by default, and I've been thinking, okay, what's my 8-man rotation in the playoffs? And I think there's an obvious 7 when you have the 5 starters, whether you call Moore or Hill a starter, doesn't matter. So that's 6. And then Darius Miller has the, you know, kind of attributes that you would want in a playoff guy. So that's 7. So I'm thinking, like, who's the 8th guy in the rotation and what would I want or need in the playoffs? And to me, the one part where these Pelicans are super susceptible is at the point guard position. And you see teams do this a lot where they'll do a 1-3 pick and roll, and then all of a sudden Nelson or Rondo is covering this huge wing in the post. Then we go to double and it just breaks our whole defense down. So what if you had a Brogdon in that role and, you know, you would just be super switchable while still having playmaking, shooting, et cetera. So Brogdon would be the guy I would take.
Huh. Yeah. So I understand what you're trying to do there and prevent that, them taking advantage of the fact that Rondo, and you're right, it's still freakish how small Rondo feels out there. But that, you know, Rondo and Jameer Nelson, that they take advantage of those guys regularly. But if you bring in a guy and he's only playing like 15 minutes a game, is that enough help? Because you're still got to be covering for a lot of time while they are out there, right?
No, I mean, I think in the playoffs, I mean, in the playoffs for sure, AD or Boogie is playing center every single second. And then you're probably running a lot of three guard lineups, a lot of, you know, two small forwards at the forward position type of stuff. So I think that's the exact type of guy you could get in an 8-man rotation and would have plenty of time and would be able to help and then would even be able to finish a game if say he was on or the mismatch was that great. But who do you think? So we both agree the 7 guys in the rotation for sure. If Hill comes back strong, that's 7. What would you say going into the playoffs you would want ideally? What type of player, you know, as the 8th man in your rotation?
Oh, and so you're saying Hill is definitely coming back strong?
Yeah, I mean, he's a rotation guy, so he's playing 3, he's playing some 4, and then, yeah, you've got Miller, and then you got the 5 guys who are starting now. So those are your 7 guys. What else would you be looking for to fill out that rotation?
To be honest, I'm actually looking for a fiend rebounder.
So just a big man or just any position?
Yeah, a big man, like power forward, like, you know, just a guy who's going to come in. And, you know, Cousins and Davis are not high energy. They've never been high energy, and we've known that all along. What would it be like if you had, like, Fareed or, you know, the 2 guys from 76ers who were tearing us apart inside? Have that guy who could come in and just cause damage in a way that lets our other bigs still take a little bit of a rest while it's happening. I would want that for the playoffs. I know there's like all kinds of limitations there, but like even if we bring in like a bigger guard or a wing who's capable of handling a little bit, I still think we're going to be stuck in the position with Drew with the ball in his hands at the end of games anyways. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess I would agree with you if I knew or felt that Gentry would allow that guy to go and do that, if we made that a part of the game plan. And yeah, I could totally see what you're saying. I don't think that would happen. And I also think in the playoffs, I think there's more TV timeouts. You're obviously getting more breaks. I mean, you never have a back-to-back. I think, you know, that our guys will play with more energy, more urgency. I mean, you see it all the time. They play in the playoffs as hard as they possibly can, which they're definitely not doing during the regular season. So I think you'll see more of that, especially from AD and Boogie in the playoffs. For me, I just still feel where the defense is most susceptible is when you have Rondo or Jameer on the court and they're just running that 1-3 pick and roll. And in the playoffs, the team's going to find your weakness and do it over and over and over again. I guess you could say that our hugest defensive weakness is Boogie, Boogie in the pick and roll, but there's really nothing you're going to be able to do about that. So, yeah, that's what I would want. I think a guy like Brogdon would be great, which, you know, we could have selected him, but we got Diallo, who were not playing a lick whatsoever. So it is what it is.
Okay. So let's talk about the games that are coming up.
Yes.
It's a road trip over the next week. So Tuesday and Friday. So they actually got a lot of rest here. This is a little surprising when I looked at the calendar and realized they got basically Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Wednesday, Thursday all off for over a week span. But they're on the road in Tuesday in Washington and Friday at Orlando and then a back-to-back the Saturday at Miami, so the little Florida hop, before they come back to face Brooklyn on Wednesday. So they get another nice couple-day break or 3-day break. Miami, Orlando, Washington. We don't get to talk about any of these guys since it's an East Coast trip very often. Who is most interesting to you?
I think Washington, because in a lot of ways, they do have some similarities. I mean, their starting lineup is second to only Houston as far as net rating. They're just absolutely fantastic when those five guys are on the floor. When they start having to mix up lineups or one of those guys is hurt, or, you know, their reserves come in, they go from being clearly the best team in the East and one of the best in the NBA to a below average team. So, we kind of saw this with Minnesota too, when the Pelicans played them, is Minnesota was another team that had a great starting lineup, and the Pelicans starting lineup actually outplayed them. But then Minnesota's bench somehow beat the Pelicans. And I don't know how that could happen with Washington, because their bench is absolutely miserable. And Porter might miss this game. He missed today because of a hip injury, and you don't know what his status is going to be. But they're just a very top-heavy team, but their top is so freaking heavy. Like, it's an elite unit, but you've just got to be able to punish them when their starters aren't in and not let the fluke game happen like it always does against the Pelicans, and not let a guy like freaking Mike Scott or somebody like that go off for Washington. So I think they're really interesting for several reasons.
So I got to say, first off, you're forgetting one really important thing. This is going to be a Tim Frazier revenge game.
Oh, I know. He's going to go for 20 and 10.
Like Frazier, whenever he went up against Lillard, you forget, he looked like an all-pro, you know, point guard. And now, you know, he's going to come back to the team that traded him away. And he's going 20 and 10. He's going to make everybody look terrible.
Yeah, no,
I'm saying that. I'm laughing. Would it surprise you if he actually pulled out like a 18-7 game on us?
No, not at all. I think that's exactly what's going to happen.
Okay. So Tim Frazier comes off the bench. He's going to be the exact kind of annoying guy. They've got Jody Meeks, who has been a shooter who's bothered us before. So their bench does have the potential to come in and make us cry. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know. If there's anybody in the league who is capable of at least making John Wall think a little bit, I think Drew might be that guy. Is there any chance you think that Drew might be able to play John Wall to at least an impasse?
Yeah, Wall's not, I mean, completely back yet. He's still kind of getting back into shape and getting a stroke. I mean, Wall is a guy that you could definitely play off of, and if you don't allow him to get into transition, now this is where the Pelicans' weakness could play right into, you know, a strength of Washington, is you get those turnovers, and you put the ball in John Wall's hand, and it's going to be 2 or 3 points. So I think Drew, if it's a half-court game, is definitely going to be able to outplay John Wall. But if the turnovers start happening, I think he's just going to absolutely punish us.
Yeah. So I do want to say one thing. I want to pat each of our backs, because talking about Washington, because I remember when Bradley Beal was in the draft, I remember looking at his stats and being like, this guy, like, stat-wise, he's not impressive. And you swore up and down, that he was going to be a legitimate, good shooting guard in the NBA, and that anybody who thought differently was crazy. So, patting you on the back, you're right, Beal's been pretty good. And then Porter was my guy in his draft. I was all in on Otto Porter. And after an abysmal rookie year, which made me feel really sad about myself, because I just didn't expect him to be that awful, he's come on and been a very, very good basketball player at the small forward position. So we actually got something right. Aren't we proud?
Yeah. For me, it was.
If you could take Beal or McCollum, which one are you taking?
Oh, Beal. Yeah.
Really?
I
McCollum was your boy.
Well, if you're talking about just pure offense, I mean, he's my boy relative to the other stuff we have. But if you're talking just pure offense, I think it's close. But Beal has the length. Beal has the ability to do some things on defense, and he also is more physical and could get to the basket and do some other things, you know, down low and in the paint. So I would take Beal. I think he has one of the best strokes I've ever seen. That's the reason why I believed in him coming out of college, even though he didn't have the stats per se. So, I think this team could be really explosive. I think this game really comes down to, in all honesty, whether the Pelicans turn the ball over and those live ball turnovers get into John Wall's hands, because I could see them getting, you know, north of 30 points in turnovers if that happens. But if the Pelicans could stay under control, not turn the ball over, and these two teams are basically playing and executing in the half court, I think the Pelicans win the game.
Yeah. Okay.
What about you? What do you like more, Miami or Orlando? Which team interests you more?
No, Orlando is not interesting to me, and it wasn't interesting to me earlier in the season, even though they were jacking up shots. And, of course, you know, Aaron Gordon's coming back from injury, and maybe he'll, you know, continue to shoot 70% from three or whatever it was originally. Somehow I doubt it. So I'd rather talk Miami, just because Miami is, again, one of those teams you're just like, yeah, how do they continue to do this? Like, I don't look at their roster and think like there's anybody who's going to be amazing, but it's not even that. It's not even like you look at them, you see a team of all pretty solid guys, but they're missing players left and right to injury this season. Winslow and Whiteside and like James Johnson's going to be out for something like 7 to 10 games and will not be playing against them. Deion Waiters missed a bunch of games before he came back from injury. I mean, you just go down their roster, and they're as riddled with injuries as anybody else who's been playing this season, and yet they're still 15-14, and they keep rolling. The only guy who has played there's two guys who have played every single game for them as starters, and that's Josh Richardson and Goran Dragic. Everybody else has missed significant games. So, I don't know. This team, it doesn't feel like it's built in a way that's going to give the Pelicans too much trouble. They've got some nice perimeter defenders, but the Pelicans are not really attacking on perimeter. They're just shooting over the perimeter. And their inside defense, especially with Whiteside missing games and out right now, I don't know if Whiteside will be back in time, but there's not really anybody who's going to make, you know, Boogie and Davis struggle. Davis versus James Johnson. Johnson's a very physical power forward. Maybe that could have done something for Miami, but if Johnson's out, I think the interior is wide open against this team. So I expect to see the Pelicans handle them fairly well. You watch a lot of games of teams like Brooklyn and other teams that I don't spend a whole lot of time. What does Josh Richardson do for this team?
I mean, he's a high energy defense, and he takes a good amount of threes. I mean, he's what you would want to say is your prototypical 3-and-D player. He just
Dragic does.
Yeah,
plays more minutes than Deion Waiters. I just looked at that. I'm like, really? Like, he's the team leader in minutes. I guess he's kind of like the Dante Cunningham effect, right? If he does all the things your coaching staff wants him to do, even if he's not doing them particularly well, at least he's doing them.
Yeah, no, he would definitely be a coach's favorite. Yeah, Miami's just the ultimate high variance team. Like, they're going to play solid defense. They have enough guys. You know, even though they don't have anybody great, they have enough kind of wing players, and they're going to play smart with Spoelstra. It's just all, I mean, whether they win or lose, it's going to be as simple as do they make their threes that night, because they're going to take a ton of them. I mean, what are they? They're averaging over 32 a game, do they shoot over 40% or do they shoot 35%? And that really, like, I always say, if I wish I could know one box call, you know, one box score thing ahead of time, and then I'll be able to predict the future. You tell me what the Miami Heat's 3-point shooting percentage in this game is, and I'll tell you if they win the game. I really think it's going to be that simple.
Okay.
I am. So you know. What's it going to be, Ryan? What percentage?
I'm supposed to read tea leaves. They're going to shoot 36.8% from three.
Pelicans win.
Okay.
There you go.
I'm glad I picked that number.
Yep. Now we know.
I'm really good at this.
Put your money down.
By the way, they do average 15 turnovers a game, so they're almost as bad as the Pelicans.
Yeah, they're
predicting wins against Washington, Miami, and a loss to Orlando.
Yeah, it doesn't. Logic doesn't matter. All you got to do is look at the pattern, and the pattern says that's exactly what's going to happen.
Pattern works out for you, huh?
I'd like to see the smug look that wiped off those Mormon faces. Because they're so smug about their great Jazz team.
Which has struggled for years. My prediction is also 2-1. I think that they're going to actually lose the Washington game and take Orlando and Miami.
Below 500.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That's all right, though. Like, they're just going to bounce back. Like, do you have any worries that at some point this team isn't going to rip off like four wins in a row and then whip off four losses in a row at some point? Like, it's just what they're going to do.
Yeah, I feel like the losses are more likely than the wins, but yeah.
Wow.
I don't think they could stay hungry or focused enough for, like, it's so hard for me to imagine them playing four or five straight games where they just, they stay focused, don't have a brain fart, and don't get too high on themselves. Like, it's so weird. Like I said, they have the mentality of a team that's been to six straight titles. But it would be hard for me to see them humbling themselves. But if they're going to do it, it's got to be somewhere in the stretch, because after that Washington game, it should be two relatively easier road games than three super easy home games. And then at Utah, who's missing Gobert after you've got 3 days of rest, then you get another 2-3 days of rest. You get to go to Minnesota, Detroit at home, Memphis, who will still have Conley gone. Like, the schedule, I think, you know, between now and the All-Star break, I would say the only team that they play that has, you know, that definitely has more talent than they do is Houston, which will be at home in late January. Literally, that's the only one between now and the All-Star break. There's no Golden State. There's no San Antonio. There's no Cleveland.
It's a Boston game. There's an at Boston.
Yeah, I would have considered that one. Okay, I'll give you that one, I guess, because okay. Kyrie's back. But that team's definitely come back down to earth, even though they're still winning a bit. A lot of their guys have come back down to earth. But fine, I'll give you that one. The point still is, though, that to me, there's no excuse for this team between now and All-Star break. They should be playing at least 600, 620 ball.
Okay, well, we'll see if that happens. So, got anything else?
That is it.
Yep, so thanks everybody for listening to In the Know. And if you tweet anything about The Last Jedi to me between, say, today and about 5 days from now, I will hunt you down and kill you.
I'm going to see it Tuesday, so you could tweet me Tuesday night.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, UNIFYD, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE system.